He's begging you. Please don't hurt my daddy. Please don't hurt my daddy.
One of the guys says, I've killed one, now you do one.
I see my father lying face down, blood all over.
Panic blankets a rural Alabama town when investigators discover the killers have a hit list.
These individuals were not going to stop until they were caught.
They shot him in the back of the head and threw him in a hole.
It's the most evil story I've ever worked on.
In depth, insightful, in a class of its own. America's leading journal, Vanity Fair, investigates Buried Alive by Buzz Bissinger.
It's a normal morning in Opelika. I mean, think about it. We all have typical days. And it became abundantly clear this was not going to be a typical day in anyone's lives.
So the morning of January 30th, the children go to school, I go to work, and every morning, when I would get to work at 8 o'clock, every morning I would call my mother and say, hey, what are you doing? And she would give me the same answer every morning. Drinking a cup of coffee, what are you doing?
Katrina calls, but there's no answer.
Hey, it's me. I'm just worried about y'all. I haven't heard from you at all. Please call me when you get in. Talk to you later. Bye.
Then calls again. No answer. Well, that's strange. At about lunchtime, now she's really scared. Now she's nervous. Now she's concerned. Something in her gut tells her something is really, really wrong. Where are they? Why haven't they called?
As the day went on, I realized, as I continued to call, I needed to go. I asked my boss if I could please run to my parents' house. And when I left, it was about a 10-minute ride. And driving there, I had just the strangest feeling. It didn't feel right.
She feels it in the pit of her stomach. Closer she gets, the feelings get worse and worse and worse.
When I pulled into the driveway, I noticed that all the cars were there. And right off, I noticed something's not right. And then I go to the back door, and it had been broken. The door was partially ajar. It was splintered in the jamb and where the doorknob would be. I walk into the kitchen and look through to the den, and there I see my father lying face down. Blood all over his shirt. And I just started yelling, Dad, Dad, Dad. He's not moving.
She fundamentally knows at that point that he's dead.
So then I immediately run down the hall yelling for my mother. And I look over into her bedroom and I see her on the other side of the bed. And I didn't call to her because I could tell that she was gone. I turned around to the hall telephone. I picked it up and there was no dial tone. So I just hung it up and I knew I had to get to somebody or a phone.
Reeling, Katrina bolts from the house and drives to the closest neighbor.
All I can remember is going in there and saying, somebody killed mom and dad. Dial 911. And I fainted.
Thurman Ratliff had a gunshot wound to his hand. He also had a gunshot wound to his lower side, and he had a fatal gunshot wound to the back of the head. Also were able to determine that Catherine Ratliff had multiple gunshot injuries. She had a gunshot wound that was to her arm region as well, also to her side and shoulder area, and she had a fatal gunshot wound to her head as well.
It's clear to investigators that 68-year-old Thurman Ratliff and his 62-year-old wife, Catherine, had been tortured.
It was very obvious that the offenders were searching for something of value inside of this house. The attic ladder had been taken from within the ceiling. The vents that cover the air conditioning units had been searched. All of the cabinets had been gone through.
I really don't know a dollar amount of money that my parents kept in their home, but I knew that they kept a decent quantity of cash in their home.
There was a discovery of money that was in the master bathroom in a small little metal canister, and we had approximately $87,000 worth of cash that the offenders had missed and left in the home.
Obviously, whoever did this, there is some motive of robbery. And obviously who did this is the incarnation of evil. But, you know, who is that? This is Opelika. I mean, you move here, so stuff like this never happens.
My father was one of the hardest working people I think I've ever met. He was an independent dealer of Snap-on tools, and he would have a route to go around to different garages and dealerships, and he would sell tools to the mechanics in different shops and things. And my mother was also a very hard worker. She managed a restaurant for a while, and she enjoyed that. She had a beautician's license, and she would do hair for elderly women. On occasion, she would cut my boyfriend's hair, and I think she really enjoyed that.
The Ratliffs had no known enemies. Their neighbors in Opelika can't imagine who would want to kill this amiable couple. Investigators begin to sift through the evidence.
The only thing that forensic could tell us at the initial stages was that it was a 9mm weapon that had been used. They also told us that they believed that there was two different weapons that had been used, which suggested that there was possibly more than one offender. During the investigation, while searching the exterior, we found someone had walked across a portion of the property, and it led us to a fence. The footprints found led us to a location away from the victim's home.
And these footprints ultimately lead to a small driving area, and they can see tire tracks. So what does that mean? That means that someone else is involved.
The fact that we had multiple offenders and multiple victims involved in this crime truly was a concern of ours.
People are terrified. It could be anyone. It could be someone from Opelika. It's clearly someone who had some knowledge of them because the house was torn apart and they're looking for something. But beyond that, who is it?
You know, I started to think about people. Is it one of the people that my father had hired to work around the home? You know, I did not know who would do this. I just could not fathom who could do that.
We checked all of the violent offenders that had been recently arrested from jail and from prison to see if they might have had any links to the community.
And I started to think, did my ex-husband do this? My ex-husband was a very abusive person. We had a horrible, horrible marriage.
We had information that Katrina Ratliff's ex-husband had made threats against Thurman and Catherine, according to Katrina.
We all knew that he was a violent person and that he was probably capable of anything.
January 30th, 2002, Katrina Ryan discovers the bodies of her parents, tortured and murdered in their Opelika, Alabama home. Investigators have no suspects until they hear what her ex-husband, Norman Herbert, did to Katrina more than 10 years earlier.
I'd left my husband. I leave work, and I'm walking through the parking lot, and all of a sudden, there he is. And he has a knife. So he pushes me into the car. He's holding me at knife point, saying, "Drive, let's go." And I can tell he's all drunk. So we go to a very secluded area, and he ties me up. I'm beaten and raped for a few hours. And at one point, he unties me, and he's just like, "Just, you know, get the hell out of here. Just go." So I did. The keys were still in the car. So I ran to the car, and I got away. It was very scary.
Katrina races to the police station to report the assault. Investigators begin to hunt for her ex-husband.
He would call at my parents' home, and he would say all kinds of things, like he was going to kill us, he was going to kill me. He stayed on the run for about 2 weeks before he was captured.
Katrina's ex-husband is arrested and charged with rape and kidnapping. He pleads guilty to the kidnapping, and the rape charge is dropped.
Katrina Ratliff's ex-husband is potentially in prison, but she was uncertain if he was still there. So we immediately wanted to investigate that angle.
Well, obviously, this man has a violent past, but when police find him, he's got an airtight alibi. He's 100 miles away in jail.
And there was no possible way that he could have committed these crimes. At that point, we did not have any other suspects, but we continued to investigate. The word of this crime soared through the community like nothing I've ever seen, because there was no real reason known why these people had been killed in their house.
2 weeks pass, and police still have no suspects. The grisly murder in nearby Opelika is still headline news on the night that 54-year-old Forrest Butch Boyer is at home with his 12-year-old son, Brett.
Butch is at the kitchen table doing some paperwork. He's laid out Brett's clothing on the bed for school.
I've known Butch now for probably 20 plus years. Butch was a great father. There was no doubt in my mind that he was doing the absolute best he could to raise Brett the right way as a single father.
Butch is a working man. He owns a used car lot. He sells cars. He's good at it. He wants his son to have everything. They live in a very, very nice home. He sends him to private school. He will do anything for that kid that he can. Now it's Sunday night. It's 10 o'clock. Time to get ready for Monday. And then there's a knock on the door at 10 o'clock at night. And that's weird.
It was later than someone would normally knock on the door. And so he was a little suspicious of that, but he went to the door. They said police search warrant.
Two guys show up. They have badges. They have a warrant. I mean, it doesn't make any sense, but they tell Butch he's under arrest for possession of drugs.
They come inside, and they went around. They ask him questions, searching for stuff.
Butch insists that this is a terrible mistake. There are no drugs in his house. But the two men take him into custody.
They handcuff him inside the house, walk him out to the car, and that's when he stops them and says, "What do we do about my son who's inside?"
Once
Mr. Boyer's handcuffed. They go get Brett and they handcuff him also. They take him out to what looks like an unmarked police car.
Butch told me that when they went past the police department, he knew that something was wrong and that he was just at that point concerned about his child.
They take Butch and Brett out to a remote area of the county known as Seal, Alabama, where US 431 was being constructed at that time.
Both sides of the four lane was there, but it was dirt. It was dark. It was extremely dark on that stretch of road.
And that's where they had a conversation with Butch about a safe and $100,000 that he had at his house. Mr. Boyer responds to the individuals that had taken him that he didn't have a safe with $100,000, but that he did have some cash and that they could have the cash if they wouldn't harm him and his son.
And so they load him back up, drive back to the house, and he shows them where his cash is in the house.
Butch Boyer takes the two men to a closet in his bedroom. Inside, they find a box with more than $40,000 in cash.
The whole time they're asking him, does he have more money hidden, other locations? He keeps telling them no. They kept insisting that he had more. They find a .38 snub-nosed pistol, which actually turned out to be his housekeeper's, and they took it. They have Butch. They have his son, Brett. So they go back out to the location, out on 431.
You've seen how dark it is, and the only thing in your heart that you can say to yourself is, please, if they have 1 ounce, 1 grain of compassion, they won't kill my son.
Butch and Brett were both taken out of the car, and both of them were still handcuffed.
Butch was pleading to let his son go, that he would find them more money. He would go get more money from the bank when it opened. He would do whatever that he felt like that he could do to let his son live.
As he pleads with his captors, Butch is horrified to discover the two men have already dug a shallow grave.
They take Butch a little bit away from where the car is, and they slit his throat. Ear to ear with a knife, because they want to kill him.
After they had cut Butch Boyer's neck, then one of the individuals got on his back and was telling him just go to sleep as he lay there bleeding from his neck.
12-year-old Brett is pleading, please don't hurt my daddy. Screaming, please don't hurt my daddy. He's just seen his daddy, his father, having his throat slit.
One of the guys who had cut his throat say to the other one, I've killed one, now you do one. The second individual takes the .38 that he took from the house and shoots Brett in the head.
Brett Boyer doesn't die from the initial wound. He didn't die immediately. He did suffer some amount of time.
As he shoots Brett in the head, he says, little mother won't die. Like it's Brett's fault. And then shoots him twice more.
Once they had shot Brett, they threw him in the grave.
They slit Butch Boyer's throat a second time, then roll him into the hole on top of his son's body, along with a .38 caliber revolver.
They put lime on them, they bury them, put the dirt on top of them.
And then as this thing unravels with more hideousness and more horror, Butch actually somehow, someway is not dead.
On a cold February night in 2002, 54-year-old single father, Butch Boyer, and his 12-year-old son, Brett, are abducted from their Phenix City, Alabama home by two men posing as narcotics officers. After robbing him, the men cut Butch's throat, shoot his son in the head, and bury them both in a shallow grave at a construction site for a new highway. But Butch Boyer is not dead.
Butch has sustained a life-threatening cut from ear to ear.
Butch Boyer was cut twice before he was placed in the grave with Brett and covered up. It was a shallow grave, and he was in a position where he could still breathe some. And then he tried to hold his breath best he could until they left.
He's got lime on top of him, dirt on top of him, and Butch hears them drive off.
Butch Boyer's in the grave, and he's still alive with his throat slit. And he's trying to dig his way out.
Butch pulls his son from the grave, but he don't want to believe that his son is dead. So he's trying to resuscitate him. He's doing everything he can think to try to save his son. At some point, he realized that his son was dead, and that's when he went to the roadway.
In the pitch black night, his body caked with dry blood and clay, Butch Boyer drags himself through the thorns and the brambles.
Butch crawls out to the highway.
It's one of the most miraculous acts of courage and physical strength that I've ever seen.
And the motorist pulls up and he sees this guy and he's thinking to himself, you know, what in the world has occurred?
911, what's your emergency?
I got a guy standing on the side of the road, he's bleeding really bad, and they said he's dead, and he said somebody killed his son.
I was about right here when I got the call. Dispatch gave it to me as a medical call. Someone had been hurt. As soon as I saw the headlights of the vehicle, I activated my dash camera.
1017, standby for 1012.
You could see his Adam's apple, you could see the veins, and basically his throat was literally down on his chest. He was covered in dirt. I mean, even the cut had dirt in it.
No bullets. I got a man, his throat's been cut to hell. He said his son's been shot three times, and he was buried and dug himself out. This is a bad one.
Within minutes, an ambulance arrives.
He was absolutely insistent. He sat in the ambulance, but he refused to leave until we had found his son.
Sergeant Powell was able to search the area and find the body of Brett Boyer.
We immediately checked him for life signs. They went and put the heart monitors on him, and everything was flatlined.
The first responder says, "Look, Mr. Boyer, if you die, we will never, ever catch these people," and that gets to him.
He told us that they drove a white Crown Vic with tinted windows, gave us an approximate year of that Crown Vic.
Mr. Boyer also related to the deputy that the individuals had taken his keys.
They got the keys in my house. Hey, Bobby, back in there trying to get some more money.
I called and asked that the Phenix City Police Department send a unit up there to the house. After 30 minutes of surveilling the house, maybe less, we see a Crown Vic matching the description that Butch had given us.
And they followed it and stopped what turned out to be Michael Carruth.
43-year-old Michael Carruth is a local bail bondsman who has no criminal history.
I was notified that there had been a stop made. Michael Carruth had a large amount of money in his pocket, that he did have some keys in his pocket, and I noticed what appeared to be blood on his shoes and on his pants. Mr. Carruth was taken into custody, and he was transported to the Russell County Sheriff's Department. His vehicle was also impounded. Once the vehicle was searched, we located numerous items of evidence, including handcuffs, shackles, narcotics officer's hat.
Carruth was exceptionally cold. I mean, he was completely emotionless. He wasn't confessing.
when they pick up Michael Carruth, you have to assume that he thinks he has an ace in the hole because he's not cooperating. He denies involvement, which obviously makes no sense because he's in the White Crown Vic. He's going by the house. But he thinks, you know what? There are no witnesses. Who were the witnesses?
Michael Carruth's demeanor changed at one specific point when one of the officers said, "Mike, I got some bad news for you." And he looked at him, and the officer said, "Butch Boyer is alive." And when he said that, all the blood drained out of Michael Carruth's face.
Carruth is getting pinned into a corner. Now he knows that Butch, despite all efforts to kill him, is alive. So he just can't say, "I have nothing to do with it."
Making things more difficult for Michael Carruth, Butch Boyer gives investigators one more key piece of information.
Mr. Boyer was able to relate that he knew one of the individuals. He recognized one of the individuals that was involved in this, and he called him by his name. Butch said that he was Jimmy Brooks Jr.
Jimmy Lee Brooks had a history of being a small-time, petty-type criminal. Brooks's father had been a repo man. He repossessed cars. Butch Boyer was in the used car business. As I understand it, he had used Jimmy Lee Brooks Sr. To repossess cars. And Junior had accompanied his father and helped him do some work for Butch Boyer.
Less than 12 hours after the kidnapping and murder, Russell County Police arrest Jimmy Brooks Jr.
When officers arrived in the area where Jimmy Brooks was, they first noticed him near a burn pile behind a residence, burning what we believe were the clothes that he had wore during the murder. Jimmy Brooks Jr. is taken into custody. When we searched Mr. Brooks' residence, we found a large amount of U.S. currency, which we believe was taken from Mr. Boyer the night before.
And they find marijuana, and in his own warped mind, he is worried that his girlfriend will be implicated, and he begins to talk.
"I will tell you from the very beginning to all the way to last night."
"Okay."
In his confession, Brooks tells officers that Carruth had posted a $35,000 bond to release him from jail 6 months earlier.
"When he got me out, my family had no money to get me out."
That means he's got his hooks in Jimmy deep, and Jimmy Lee Brooks is going to have to do what Carruth tells him.
At some point, Jimmy Brooks could not pay the fees that he owed for the bonding company, and Michael Carruth approached him about working with him other ways.
It was Jimmy Lee Brooks who told Michael Carruth that Butch Boyer had $100,000 and he kept it in a safe, that he had seen that when he went to Butch's home with his father.
Brooks and Carruth were planning to build a underground hydroponics marijuana system. So they were trying to raise money for this system.
Brooks says during his confession that the plan was always to leave Butch and his son Brett at the construction site. That makes no sense. They pre-dug a grave. They bought lime. Make no mistake, they went out there to execute them.
Michael Carruth walked Butch down the away from where they were at the car, got him on his knees and cut his throat. And Carruth came back and said, "I did one, you've got to do the other."
"The little boy's just standing there, you know, don't know what's going on."
And that's when Jimmy Lee Brooks shot Brent.
Jimmy Lee is on a roll. He says, "You know, I got something else I might be able to tell you."
He says that, "I was involved in this one, but I can also tell you about another one that happened in Lee County."
Remember that murder in Opelika of this elderly couple? I know who did it.
Russell County Police arrest two men for the murder of 12-year-old Brett Boyer and the attempted murder of his father, Butch. Michael Carruth and Jimmy Lee Brooks Jr. In his confession, Brooks admits to shooting Brett. Carruth denies hurting anyone.
"I harmed and killed anybody, and as a fact, part of that.
But Jimmy Lee Brooks Jr. isn't done talking.
During the questioning of Brooks, he confessed to exactly what had occurred, everything from Carruth cutting Butch's throat to Brooks shooting Brett. And at the end of that, he started confessing to the Ratliff murder in Lee County.
Brooks tells investigators that it was Michael Carruth who planned the Ratliff robbery.
We discovered later that they actually had a list of a number of people in the area that they believed kept large sums of money at their house. It was sort of like a hit list.
The Boyers are on it, and the Ratliffs are on it, because word on the street is they have a lot of cash.
Jimmy Lee Brooks actually worked for the Ratliff family's son. And that while he was working for him, he learned that they possibly had money that they stored in their house.
And Brooks admits something else. There was a third man involved in the robbery.
Brooks also introduces a third person into the mix who he says also shot the Ratliffs that night, and his name is James Gary.
Investigators quickly discover that James Gary, a 28-year-old Alabama native, is already incarcerated in the Russell County Jail on drug charges. On the morning of February 19th, Captain Van Jackson questions James Gary. He claims he was forced to take part in the crime for the same reason as Jimmy Lee Brooks Jr.
Michael Carruth bonded out James Gary, and they became acquainted through that process. James Gary says that he felt pressured by Michael Carruth to be involved in the crimes because he owed money for being bonded out. He said the night started when Michael Carruth picks up the other two. Michael Carruth takes the two, Gary and Brooks, to the Ratcliffe's home.
Michael Carruth drops off Brooks and Gary near the Ratliff home. Brooks tells investigators that Carruth gave them specific instructions on what they had to do to the elderly couple.
He says, if you have to kill, kill.
The back door of the Ratliff home was forced open by them kicking it in. Mr. Ratliff jumps up. He is confronted by Jimmy Lee Brooks and Gary. They force him or throw him to the ground.
Once they break into the Ratliff home, they ask, where's the cash? And Thurman says he doesn't know, or is trying to lay them off in a sense, and he's shot in the hand.
Catherine, she starts to run down the hallway to get away from the attackers. She is pursued by Jimmy Lee Brooks.
Obviously, she's terrified. She knows that her husband has been shot. Brooks comes in, and she's apparently trying to get a gun of her own to defend herself.
He physically fought with her to prevent her from getting this weapon. And during that process, he became more and more angry with her as he continued to demand that she tell him where the money was. She did, at some point, fall to her knees and start begging for her life.
And that's when he kills her.
According to Gary, when Brooks returns to the living room, he demands Gary shoot Thurman. Gary fires one shot, hitting Mr. Ratliff in the lower back.
So at this point, James Gary says that Jimmy Lee Brooks takes the weapon from him and shoots Thurman Ratliff and kills him.
Normally in a robbery, you want to find the cash, but the motive in this case is to kill, because both Thurman and Catherine are killed, and then they look for the money.
We have two different accounts of the amount of money that was found. One of the defendants said that they had gotten approximately $25,000. And then James Gary said that they had gotten about $30,000. The money itself had been found inside of an air conditioning vent that was in the hallway of the home.
Brooks and Gary are in the Ratliff house, and they're killing two innocent elderly people. Michael Carruth is washing his car.
They had some small handheld radios that they used for communication. At that point, they contact Michael Carruth, and he picks them up and they head back towards Russell County, and they disperse the money.
Captain Jackson confronts Michael Carruth with James Gary's accusations.
Michael Carruth thought that he was smarter than the system and that he knew more than anyone else, and that there was no way that he was going to ultimately be found guilty of these crimes.
Michael Carruth maintained that he didn't kill anybody.
On April 16th, 2002, a Russell County grand jury overseeing the Boyer case indicts Michael Carruth on four counts: capital murder, attempted murder, kidnapping, and robbery. Michael Carruth continues to deny cutting Butch Boyer's throat.
With Carruth, we didn't have a confession. So, I mean, we knew that that was something that we had to prove to this jury beyond any doubt, that Michael Carruth was involved, that it, indeed, this is Michael Carruth's crime.
I mean, he's the puppeteer. He's the one who has the hit list. But unless they find a definitive piece of evidence that can truly link him up to the murders, not just the crime scenes, he may get away with this.
Michael Carruth and Jimmy Lee Brooks Jr. are charged with the kidnapping of Butch Boyer and the murder of his 12-year-old son. But Carruth denies any role in the attack. The police need direct evidence to get a conviction.
When we arrested Michael Carruth, we noticed what appeared to be blood on his shoes and on his pants.
The sample from one leg of the jeans was Butch Boyer's blood, to a genetic certainty. The other sample was a mixture of Michael Carruth's blood and Butch Boyer's blood.
Tying the DNA to Carruth was extremely important in our case.
Facing charges for capital murder, attempted murder, kidnapping, and robbery, Carruth goes to trial in Russell County in September of 2003.
Butch was there every day. He sat through the whole thing.
I assure you that Michael Carruth was beyond deflated to know that despite the fact that he cut this man's throat, he was still alive. And he was going to be there. He was going to stand up in the courtroom and point out Michael Carruth. I don't think he has any remorse that he cut Butch Boyer's throat and did his best to kill him. Brent was begging them, please don't hurt my daddy. And and they shot him in the back of the head and threw him in a hole and put his father on top of him and covered him up. That's as merciless as I can imagine.
On October 9th, the jury finds Michael Carruth guilty on all counts and sentences him to death. 4 months later, on February 9th, Jimmy Lee Brooks Jr. is found guilty on the same four counts.
I was looking at him. He had that sort of dead-eye look that low-life killers have. But what was more interesting was the way in which he turned around and saw me, and in the middle of court said, what are you looking at? Normally in court, you're going to be polite and quiet. That said to me that this is a really combative, dangerous, confrontational individual.
I believe that the jury was out in the Jimmy Lee Brooks trial less than 30 minutes. They convicted him, and then they recommended the death penalty.
James Gary goes to trial in Lee County in 2005. With Carruth and Brooks already sentenced to death for killing Brett Boyer, James Gary alone stands trial for the murders of Thurman and Catherine Ratliff.
When it was time for the trial, I was the very first witness on the stand. And it was very difficult for me to be in the same room with someone that I knew had taken part of murdering my parents. It was very hard, very hard.
On August 4th, 2005, James Gary is found guilty of capital murder. He is sentenced to life without the possibility of parole.
I was very upset because I believe he should have been given the death penalty also. He's still alive. He gets to live every day.
They were just people like any other people. This wasn't passion or self-defense or anger. This was just about money.
I think it is a safe assumption that these individuals were not going to stop until they were caught.
You know, when something of this nature, something this evil, the heart of darkness occurs, you can't really explain it.
If I could say anything to them, I would just like to say, you could have taken everything. You could have taken the furniture, the carpets, the drapes, everything. You didn't have to kill them. You could have just left them. You didn't have to kill them. Sorry. I miss everything about my parents.